Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm Jason Sweat. A quick word before today's episode. If you're a Rails developer, there's a good chance you're writing tests. If you want to get better at writing tests, or if you're not currently writing tests and you want to learn how, go to codewithjason.com where you can find my free Ruby testing micro course. Now on to the episode. Welcome to the Rails with Jason podcast. This episode is a little bit different in that it's non-technical. We're going to talk about freelancing and entrepreneurship and that kind of stuff. I myself have done a lot of kind of entrepreneurial endeavors online over the last 10 years, and I'm going to talk about that stuff. And here to talk with me today is Mike Buckby, who is the founder of Expedited Security. Mike, do you want to introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. Like Jason said, I founded a company called Expedited Security. And, you know, we have a couple different products that work in the Heroku and other cloud ecosystems. I'm a former Rails Ruby freelancer. Hopefully, you know, happy to discuss like my route into this. And, you know, when you think about like my people are developers. I've always felt that. And so I feel a lot of protection about them. And I always want to see that developers of all kinds have the best shot at things and have the best shot at whatever route into entrepreneurship they're interested in. So,
yeah, and I think this is something a lot of developers are into. For some reason, it seems to me that especially like Rails developers tend to be especially entrepreneurial as opposed to, I don't know, Java developers or something like that. That's just a total unfounded hunch, though. I don't know if that's true.
I think it might be. I think Rails in particular is still the best way. If you have an idea for a SaaS and you need to like turn around and make it and like next month launch it, I think Rails is still your number one best, you know, route to make that happen. I think a lot of the other ecosystems where like Ruby is used a little bit in the enterprise and things when you get into like Java and .NET, and certainly you can make a SaaS based on those. I don't think it lends itself to quite the same thing. Or at least the emphasis of the larger community isn't the same thing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And it may well be that like, at least on the coasts, the Rails is really popular. It's a popular choice for building a startup application for, I think, those reasons. You can get something going really quickly.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking a lot about freelancing. Like I said, I used to be a Rails freelancer. And I think, you know, you talk about what are the paths you can take. I think a tremendous path to take into running your own SaaS or having products and services is to start with freelancing. Where with freelancing, you are solving people's problems for money. And you know those problems are painful enough that someone is willing to pay you, you know, X $100 an hour, whatever your rate is, to address those. And, you know, my products really came out of that where, you know, every product I was doing had at least enough security that, oh yes, we need to have SSL on this. Like that's a no-brainer. And so my first product was really Expedited SSL, which is an add-on in the Heroku ecosystem, which makes it just dead simple to get an SSL cert installed within Heroku on your application. And that came from consulting where, you know, previously I was charging people money just as part of the project. And at the time, SSL was still like real flaky in terms of the setup. And it was still possible to make a lot of mistakes. And so I would bill people 4 to 8 hours, say like, we're going to get this set up today. We have to go through all these different steps. I'm going to need help from your technical staff because we need access to certain, you know, admin email addresses or to make a DNS change. It's not something I can do. We have to coordinate this. And, you know, it's going to take, you know, this thing. Never had any pushback on that. No one ever said like, oh yeah, that seems like a ton of time. They're like, oh no, yeah, SSL, it's really hard to set up. And so to take, you know, something that was, you know, 48 hours at $100 an hour, whatever math you do, and then turn that into a literally five minute process where you just click next, and then there's a small charge for it. Tremendous, you know, tremendous immediate value to that. And that's, I think, a sort of unusual route. But I have other friends who have started SaaS applications out of Rails consultancies where
let's talk about this. I want to learn more about like how exactly that came about. I want to put it in context too. Maybe we could even like just back up a little bit and go through it chronologically, and you can tell maybe your story of how you started freelancing and got into the expedited SSL stuff out of that. And I can talk a little bit about what I did too. But first, let me ask you, when did you first start going from just like regular employee to doing your first freelance work, whether that's freelance work on the side or full time?
So I had started off, I actually have a degree in business finance, unused, and sort of taught myself programming and got a job out of college doing like network support and a little bit of software development, just a small consultancy I was working at in Ohio. And from there, worked through a variety of different jobs, a lot of corporate jobs. I worked for 3M, a company that was bought by another company that was then bought by 3M. And I really didn't like that extremely large corporate sort of system.
What didn't you like about it?
At one point I had had, I think, 8 different managers in the span of about 18 months.
Oh, wow.
And through that was through, they were doing acquisitions, they were restructuring, they were moving things around, and it just, there was no sense of controlling my own fate that, you know, I could do the absolute best job in the world and still there could be a mandate from literally 10 levels higher in the company that says like, oh, this division, we're making some changes, we're going to get rid of it. And
yeah, that kind of stuff sucks. I've certainly worked in a lot of situations like that where you work on something for however long, could be several months, and then at the end of it, it never even gets used. And so it's like, okay, I got paid, so in a sense, it wasn't a waste of time. But like, I read this book, this kind of interesting book called Early Retirement Extreme. The guy wrote, would you be willing to go to a job where you just write on a piece of paper all day, I am working? And it's kind of like that, where it's like you're doing something that's literally has no value to anyone. And so it's really unfulfilling to do that kind of work.
Oh, absolutely. That just drives me nuts. I could not do that. I mean, if I had to not starve, but I mean, that's the level it would need to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked at AT&T for a little bit. This is a different kind of like corporate torture. But we were building this thing. They called it the GNOC. It stands for like Global Network Operations Center or something like that. And this is actually like, man, I had to sign like an NDA and all this stuff, so I probably just said like a super secret thing that I'm not supposed to say. So I'll wait for the calls from the lawyers from AT&T. But without talking about the actual content of the thing, I was building a static HTML page, and I worked on it for 4 months, not because it was a complicated page, but because it was so like absurdly inefficient. We would have a call each week with me, my boss, my boss's boss, and my boss's boss. And we would get on the call and be like, oh, so, what do we want to talk about this week? And then we would futz around for a little bit. And at the end of the call, they'd be like, yeah, Jason, add like a space before that one word. You think you can do that by like next week? Okay, thanks. And then I'd get off the call and make the change in like 5 minutes and then have nothing to do for the whole rest of the week. And that was like months.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of big companies are probably like that.
Yeah. And they still make a lot of money somehow, which is interesting. So.
Yeah, just through their inertia. Like the smart people started and grew the company like 100 years ago and now they're just like coasting off of that. That's kind of an exaggeration, but there's some truth to that.
Yeah. In those situations, I've always wanted to just say like, you know what? I think I have a good idea of what you're actually asking for. Why don't you just let me go build the end product? It'll take me a week and then come back and you can tell me what's wrong with it. And that would be a much more efficient use of all of our time. They're like, oh no, we have to go through the right steps and the change process and the,
yeah. Yeah. It's terrible. Okay. So I think we can all agree that that's terrible. So you went from that and what happened next?
So I taught myself Rails, and how I did that was I made a number of little side projects. These were just things for myself. So I knew how to do some development work, and that was mostly in the Microsoft ecosystem. But I had heard Rails is so good for making, really robust web applications, like batteries included sort of web applications. And so that's where I started. And so one of my earliest things I made is something that's still online, which is forgoodstrftime.com.
Yeah.
So that's just a site that helps you with STRF time formatting, because that's what I was teaching myself at the time. And I thought, oh, this would be like a neat little resource. But it exercised, you know, a lot of those same things, like actually putting something online, not just like doing this exercise, you know, out of a book. And that, you know, that has a different set of skills, like actually deploying and shipping is a skill. And right. So, you know, to put that online and to have it where people could actually use it and get feedback and things. And so I had, you know, three or four of these different, demonstrable examples of work that I could prove that, oh, I knew how to do this. And I got hired as a sort of halfway co-founder by a guy who was making a startup in DC that was servicing events. So these are like big festivals and different things. And so I got
How did this happen? You said you got hired by, tell me, how did that come about?
Literally, I think I saw like a job posting and I just applied for it and said like, hey, you know, I'm currently working in the area. I'm doing this different stuff. I have all these different projects, and sent them my resume, and they really needed someone who was kind of a project manager to work with these big events companies and to, to take hold of their projects.
Okay. And were you like specifically looking for freelance work at the time?
I was looking to get out of where I was. So, yeah. So at that point I was hired as a full-time employee. And so, but that was my first like production level Rails work. And so I worked with them and ended up one of the big contracts I had was with South by Southwest. And so I built for a couple of years South by Southwest's official scheduling system Rails. And so that's the system where everyone goes in and post getting your ticket, you can build your own schedule and it would do things like it'd make a custom RSS podcast feed for you of like the bands that you were going to go see. So you could sort of like listen to them ahead of time. And
what year was this?
This is probably like 2010, 2011.
So okay.
This is a while ago.
I was just curious because I went to South by in 2008, so it'd be kind of a neat coincidence if you built that and I went to it the next year or whatever.
Yeah, so I did that and then a bunch of other large event companies, and then it sort of came about that events are a tough market to sell into because they tend to think of people as giving them things to access their audience. Mm. So they tend to think in terms of sponsorship. And so they, other than like a physical venue to have a conference at, most conferences don't want to spend any money on anything. That they Makes want sense. Everything to come in as a sponsorship. And so they saw this as like, how come you're not just giving this to us as a sponsor? And so
that business didn't work out?
That business didn't work out. And so then I tried a couple other things, but was mostly freelancing. And so,
sorry, let me ask you something about that one real quick before we move on. So you mentioned the approach of like, so wait, what technologies were you using before Rails?
.NET.
So. Okay. So you're using .NET and you were interested in Rails. So you built like some side projects in Rails and then got your first paid work. It sounds like kind of by that method. And that's the exact same route that I took. And that's the same approach that I recommend to a lot of people. My question for you is, how hard was it to go from these side projects to this production gig? Was that a big leap or was that easy? Was it scary? Not scary? How did that go?
It was definitely scary. And it was definitely under the gun. And like an interesting thing about events is that they happen at a fixed date and time. So things have to work by that time, mm-hmm. and they have to be functional, or else, you know, it's worthless. I mean, you can't like put up the site a week later. So it had very hard deadlines that I had to meet. And I think that really pushed me to make sure that things were done well, well tested, were functioning correctly. And so I think that was a good proving ground to myself just to figure these things out and to make sure that, you know, things had to work. So I had to make them work. So I had to really step up and do that. So,
did you ever get a sense that the imposter was going to be revealed or anything like that?
Oh yes. always imposter syndrome. Like even today, I still feel like that. I feel like so much of everything is luck, that, you know, you can do things that maybe increase your chances of having better luck, but you know, there's still a huge amount of luck in all of this, like making that jump, like from corporate into a smaller company and more responsibility and things, that was luck in a lot of ways. It was luck in terms of timing. It was luck in terms of, you know, sort of clicking with that group, and being given that chance. And, you know, that it was such a good fit for some of my other skills that I brought to it as far as project management and other work. So,
yeah. Yeah, I agree that luck is a big factor. At the same time, it wasn't luck that you went out of your way to build these Rails side projects and that you had the volition or whatever to go and look for these job postings and find that job and stuff like that. So it's, of course, a product of luck and the work that you do.
Yeah. And so you can, I try to work on the stuff I can control, but,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, all you can really do is work hard and do the right stuff and hope that you get lucky. And I think that like, if you work long enough and do the right stuff, then you do get lucky. And just like a side note, the world doesn't reward hard work. It rewards correct work. And so it's obviously possible to work really hard for a long time and not get anywhere. Because hard work isn't just the answer. You have to do the right stuff too.
Yeah. I mean, you said correct. I like the term directed, that, you know, that it's really deliberate and you're really trying to go towards a goal. You're trying to move towards something.
That's very true.
That helps a lot. So,
Okay, so coming back to like the thread of the story, you were working at this job, then you got this other job doing the event related stuff in Rails. What happened after that?
So after that, I, you know, it basically dissolved and had a little bit of time, and I started then just going into freelancing. And so some of the contacts I had made during that, I was referred to, and I built out a real early like sports betting site, along with mobile apps, and dabbled in mobile apps.
Somebody hired you to do this?
Yeah, that was my first big freelancing contract.
Okay, and how did you find that one?
That was a referral through one of the investors of the events company.
Interesting. And did he just reach out to you from out of nowhere, or did you talk to that person, or how did that go?
It was a referral. I mean, it landed in my lap. I didn't really do any sales for it, but they had seen, the actual product from the event work, and they said, well, we kind of need something like that, but you know, like it needs to do these other three things too. So did a lot of work with, that in terms of building out this gamified sort of sports betting, application.
Two questions for that one. And you can like talk about dollar amounts or not talk about dollar amounts depending on what you're comfortable with, but how long did that gig last, and how did you decide how much to charge?
I think they actually came to me with guidance on budget, and then I pushed back a little bit. I think it was around $130 an hour, and it lasted about 6 months. So it had a lot of moving parts in it.
So did they come to you and they were like, we want to pay you $130 an hour?
I think they, I think they had an idea of around 100 that they had been told by someone else, like, that's, if you want a reliable developer who can do this. And they had been burned by, I think they had tried to offshore this and they got something back that, and they had spent tens of thousands of dollars and got nothing. And, you know, this, you know, wholly unusable prototype that was just the, not even like, people talk a lot about like code quality or, you know, robustness and things. This was wrong conceptually. Like it was just the wrong approach. It didn't do, like, it needs to do X. It does Y. That doesn't fit. Like it was that level of off. And so I think they were at the right point where they're like, we need something better. We need someone who understands what needs done. And so I think that was an easy sell to them in that. We need to pay for quality at some level. And so,
I think there's an interesting lesson there. And I recently had a similar story with a client where he had hired like a $30 an hour freelancer. And that just like never really got off the ground because the person's skills weren't strong enough. And then later he hired like an $80 an hour freelancer. And that was okay. The person was more skilled, but like the person wasn't able to dedicate enough time and stuff like that because it like it wasn't enough to make it interesting enough to that person for that person to like spend enough time on it, I think. And then I charged a lot more than that. And that has worked out great for everybody involved. And so like I think a lot of people think that like they need to keep their rates affordable and like affordability is a selling point and stuff like that. But I think it's actually the opposite. The more you charge, the better you're seen as being, although there is kind of a ceiling somewhere. Like there was a certain, and I'm being a little bit cagey about numbers because I'm not as comfortable as I used to be talking about specific dollar amounts. But I had raised my rates over the years and I found like a ceiling around like $100 an hour where the perceived market rates were like good developers charge around $100 an hour, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But once you get into like a lot more than that, you start to get the question, why should I pay you so much more than I pay my other developers? And you kind of have to have an answer to that question. And I didn't before. And I do now because like I have my podcast and book and strong online web presence and conference talks and all that kind of stuff. Like today I'm somebody and back then I was nobody, you know? I mean, not in terms of worth as a human being, of course, but in terms of like perceived authority as a programmer and stuff like that.
I'm not even sure it's perceived. Mm-hmm. Like I would say demonstrable. Like in the same way I was talking about the side projects, like those are not just that I did this, but I can demonstrate it. I can go look at it yourself, you know, like, and like occasionally I have to give advice like to other people who are trying to get into this. And I always say like, you need a portfolio that says like, here's what I did. Here's the project. Here's like a screenshot of it that makes it seem more real, that it makes it seem more like you're doing stuff.
Did you have that stuff back then when you got this like $130 an hour project?
Yes. So
what did you have?
I had a now defunct website that I did exactly that I listed out all the past work I've done and was exactly in that format. Because a lot of the things I had done prior to that, like, and we don't need to get into like every project I've ever done, but you know, little one-off projects and things are still useful, but a lot of stuff doesn't see the light of day because either, you know, it's behind a firewall, it's a corporate project, or it's something that through no work of your own, it went away. That, you know, especially as a consultant, you know, I feel very strongly like I'm hired to consult. You ask me to do this, I'm going to give you my best opinion. I'm going to put in a bunch of work on it and try really hard to make this happen for you. But ultimately, this is your idea that I'm trying to execute on. And if it's a bad idea, that's not on me. I will try to make this happen for you, but that's their risk in it. So
let's talk about this for a second. I want to make a distinction between like consulting and contracting, because I think the vast majority, in my experience, and tell me if your experience is different, the vast majority of programmers who are freelancers or who programmers who call themselves consultants, they really are just contractors working at an hourly rate, and the substance of the work isn't meaningfully different from what you would do at a job. So most of my freelance gigs have been like staff augmentation. So yeah. I'll work with the client. I'll basically be part of their team. I'll attend all their meetings. An outside person like wouldn't be able to tell that I'm not an employee, basically. And in fact, at the last place I worked, it was staff aug. And like the people I worked with on a daily basis for months, we would make some comment about like, oh, just take some PTO or whatever. And I'd be like, actually, I'm a contractor. And they're like, what? You're a contractor? After working together for like 6 months and talking on almost a daily basis. So just to like illustrate that it's really like not a meaningful difference from employment. So people do that. And it's funny, like I read this thing, like this guy put out this guide to winning long-term contracts as a freelancer. And it's like, yeah, it takes the same amount of sales effort to win like a 2-year project as it does for like a 1-month project. So you're better off with the 2-year ones. And it's like, okay, well, if longer is better, would like a 10-year project be the best? And then like, what's the point of even freelancing anymore? Cause you're totally not. So that's my experience with like 95% of freelance programmers. Has that been your experience too, Mike?
Yes. And I think it's, you know, like all this stuff, it's a spectrum. And so what you're describing in terms of staff augmentation, you know, I live somewhat close to DC, and that's a really big thing in the government, where like the State Department or one of the 3-letter agencies. And so I know people that have like some certain subspecialty that they're really good at, and like Java, like portlets. I'm familiar with those, like little dashboard widget kind of stuff that works in Java kind of things. They happen to be an expert on that. They get hired at $250 an hour, 40 hours a week. And they're basically in all but name an employee of the State Department. And they go in, they have to be there at a certain time. That's a clock out at a certain time, just like employees. But, you know, they're paid $250 an hour. And that's like a dream job for some people. And that's great, you know. And I think, you know, those are interesting jobs in a lot of ways. And
that is interesting, because like that in certain criteria, that's success, you know, because like 40 hours a week for a year, that's like $500,000 a year. That's pretty great if you look at it in certain ways. But also, you're not getting any of the freedom benefits that freelancing supposedly gives you. And so in a different way, that would totally not be success. Like for me, if you told me that I could go work for a year and make $500,000, but I had to like go to an office every day, I honestly don't know if I would want to do it, because that sounds terrible.
Yeah. There's a lot else that goes into that, as far as, well, what happens when that's done? You know, that, oh, you know, it's because of the same thing. You're working in this giant organization. They can decide like, well, we have to cut back on projects. So, you know, this is all happening, or government furlough, or, you know, all sorts of, there's a lot out of your control that can happen there. So it's hard to say. And you have to, it's all trade-offs, but yeah.
I mean, there's trade-offs in that scenario, but also it is possible to bill $250 an hour or the equivalent of that and also have the freedom and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I don't want to paint the picture that it's either or. Are you familiar with Alan Weiss by chance?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know.
So. Yeah. He wrote this book called Million Dollar Consulting. And Alan Weiss himself is a consultant, and he bills over $1 million a year. And he claims that he works like fewer than 20 hours a week. And that's pretty interesting to me because he like seems to have it figured out. And so I've been trying to figure out like how do I apply what he does with his consulting to what I do and get to there. Because for me, you know, to bill $1 million a year and work less than 20 hours a week, that sounds like the best of both worlds. So I think it is possible, but it's really, really hard, I think, to get from like hourly programmer to anything close to that.
Yeah, I think so. We're talking about the spectrum of this. So we said like, oh, the guy at the State Department, the person at the State Department, $250 an hour. I think the other end of the spectrum, in the positive way, would be someone who has a productized service where they've separated it from billing per hour and they're, say, like an expert at Postgres optimization. And so when you need that, you can pay them $10,000. They will make Postgres sing for you and you can feel great about that. And it's not exactly tied to an hourly rate that, you know, that it's some other system for that. And I see that a lot in not even so much the very technical areas that we work in, but when you start to get into things like very high level copywriters. Like,
ooh, let's talk about this because
sure.
I hear this term a lot. I've heard this term a lot over the last several years, but I haven't seen a lot of examples. And what I certainly haven't seen a lot of is programmers who have said, I want to start a productized service, and then they do it and they're successful with it. I've seen that progression happen pretty much never. So I'm always looking for like real concrete examples of people who do this. One that comes to mind for me is Nate Berkopek. He does Rails performance related stuff. So he does like, so he gets a lot of his, and I think he talks about this publicly, like he gets a lot of his revenue from his book sales and stuff like that. And then he does workshops and a lot of his revenue comes from that. And then he'll do consulting where basically the client hires him and says, hey, our app is too slow. We need it to be faster. And then he makes it faster and he gets paid for that. That's an example of a real productized service. Do you know any other examples of actual productized services? Because I think that's like kind of the only one that I know of.
It doesn't exactly fit as a productized service, but I think it's similar in execution. Andrew Culver has a Rails framework called Bullet Train that he sells and then also does consulting on top of.
Got it. Yeah, I knew that he did like, I knew he sold that. I didn't realize the consulting part of it.
I'd recommend him as another guest for you potentially. I'm friends with him. But I think he's, and you know, we're sort of still going down the path of talking about like, you know, how to move from freelancing into, you know, a SaaS or other business. But he is also one of the examples I've seen where he took a freelance role he had and said, I will give you a deal on this. I will cut my rate 20%. I don't know if that's exactly it, but some percentage. I will retain ownership of this portion of it for you. And I'm going to take and make this a SaaS and you can be my first customer. And I will give you this deal on it, but you know, you aren't interested in breaking this off. So I know I have two friends who have both done really well with that model.
Interesting.
Where they've said, you know, negotiating as part of the freelance rate, ownership of the code and the ability to turn it into a real product. And that works so well, I think, because again, you know, I started this off by saying, you know, people that are willing to pay hundreds of dollars an hour to have someone write something for them have real pain.
Exactly.
And so you're immediately starting off with like your first customer who has real pain. You can immediately just keep rolling on their issues. They usually act as a reference because you have a great relationship with them because, you know, you're doing all this work and you're in contact with them. And then that just flows so naturally into that. And as far as a pattern, you know, that's something I had with Expedited SSL. And that's something I've seen, you know, replicated elsewhere. And, you know, we talk about productized service. The ultimate thing isn't even to do that. It's to sit back and have a piece of software you wrote doing the work that you then get paid for.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's again, all this is on a spectrum of different things. And there's other pieces in, like, you know, support contracts and things. Like, I've done that in some other cases.
Okay, so there's so many thoughts I have on this and so many things I want to ask. First, I'm just trying to think of what makes sense. Okay, so I want to talk about, like, the genesis of ideas and where successful ideas come from. I've spent so many years, man, how do I frame this without telling my whole life story? But I started like around 2008 trying to build products online. At this time, I only was really aware of two career paths. I was aware of like full-time employee forever or like VC-funded startup. I didn't even realize that you could just build a business online. It sounds crazy now that I didn't even realize that, but I didn't realize that you could just build a business online that makes money. But I started that around 2008, and I called my attempts startups, although I realize now they weren't startups, they were just online businesses. And they weren't even online businesses because they never made any money. But I came up with those ideas by brainstorming. And none of those ideas that I came up with by brainstorming were successful. Like, for example, I built this website where you could announce where you wanted to go to lunch. In the morning, you would announce where you want to go to lunch so that by the time lunchtime rolled around, everybody in the office would kind of have the decision made. Never went anywhere. I just like brainstormed that idea up. As opposed to ideas of mine that have been more successful, like I started a product that does scheduling for hair salons. It ultimately turned out to be a terrible idea, but I didn't come up with that idea by brainstorming stuff. My wife got a job at a hair salon and it like showed me that problem. And then later, I wrote an ebook about Angular and Rails, how to use Angular with Rails. And that came out of me trying to use Angular and Rails together. I didn't like sit around and brainstorm 20 ideas. I had that problem myself. And so I worked to solve that problem. And as I look at people who have had successful businesses, like I go read the interviews on Indie Hackers, I go to MicroConf and meet the people at MicroConf, and I ask myself, where did these people find their ideas? I find that they never brainstormed those ideas. They were like dragged through these experiences where they encountered these ideas that nobody would ever brainstorm up. Like Moralware, it's scheduling software for concrete countertop fabricators, I believe it is. Nobody ever would have brainstormed that up. But like the guy's brother-in-law or something was a countertop fabricator. So I want to bring that up because like I think it's helpful just to realize that you're much more likely to find a successful idea by encountering it in the wild than by trying to dream something up in isolation.
I think that's definitely the case. And I think it's, you know, it's a mix that you need to be, you know, position yourself skill-wise to where you can take advantage of that. And, you know, as an example of, you know, I am not a mobile developer. Like that is not a skill I really have, especially in the current mobile ecosystem. Like, and so I could have the world, I could come into contact with a problem that a mobile app would really solve. I couldn't really do anything with it. Like I'd have to spin up my skills. I'd have to I'd have to do a whole bunch of stuff. Whereas a web app, you know, I'm positioned to find that. So I think it's that mix of things where it's these opportunities you run into through different areas and then having the skills to take advantage of them, where success really comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And a lot of the ideas that are successful are like, they are boring, like selling shovels kind of ideas. You know, there's that thing about, oh crap, why am I not remembering it? But you know, the gold rush thing where the people who actually made the money were the people selling the shovels and stuff and not the people actually mining for gold. And it's totally the case. And I think there's like a developer reluctance. People want to build something quote unquote real and not just like a tool to enable something else. But so many successful products are just tools like Heroku, AWS. Those are totally like selling shovels type things. Your product, Expedited SSL, that's a selling shovels type thing. What I'm doing with Rails testing, that's selling, like that's usually a pretty safer bet than like my attempt at building scheduling software for hair salons. And that's a whole different story about why that was bad. But like some like technical tool is often a better bet to be successful.
So I wrote this thing a long time ago. It's on Medium still. I can find it, but it's really trying to quantify what you just said. And so I look at it as, you know, the startup, you know, project difficulty access. And so there's two axes. One is B2C versus B2B. And the more B2C it is, the more difficult it is because it's harder to pick up customers at scale. That, you know, it has to be a mass market thing because each customer, each interaction is only worth 50 cents or something. You know, if you're selling a dollar app, by the time you take out how much your time is, how much Apple charges, you're making 50 cents a transaction and it's brutal. So you need thousands and thousands of these. At the other end is like enterprise B2B, which is, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, but you know, in there, you know, there's a spectrum. And then the other axis is DFY versus DIY. So done for you versus do it yourself. And I think developers have a big tendency to make DIY products that are purely tools and not so much done for you things that just take care of it. And so I really viewed Expedited SSL's success as this is not almost, it just takes care of SSL for you. It doesn't teach you how to do it better. You just click the buttons. We try to make all the decisions for you about like which cert, how to set it up. It just says, do this, it will be done. And I think those work and are a lot easier to sell because the value's higher than trying to, you know, set it up and do it a different way. And so those are usually how I look at ideas. Like, is this business to consumer or is it B2B? Is it DIY or is it DFY? And that's a general way of looking at a lot of these different products that talk about success. Like you were mentioning the countertop people. That is very done for you. It's very B2B in that it tells you, you know, and, you know, you can quibble about it, but it's the exercise of thinking about it that, you know, you're trying to evaluate what to do. I think it's useful. So.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to get back to the story and I want to try to draw us to a conclusion sometime in the next, sure. In the next maybe 15 minutes or so, just so I don't take, we could probably talk about this all day and I hope you'll be up for a follow-up episode too. Cause there's so much more we could talk about. Let's see. So, and by the way, I want to add a meta note. I think a much better, and I'm curious about your opinion on this, Mike. I think a much better way to learn what really works and doesn't in entrepreneurship is ignore advice and just study what people actually did that really worked. Because a lot of the people who give advice, even successful people, they don't really understand why they're successful, or they don't understand exactly what they did. What part of what they did is the thing that made them successful. There's this post called like How I Won the Lottery or something like that. I haven't read it, but it's like the idea of people fooling themselves into thinking I did X and so I was successful, therefore X made me successful, when really X wasn't even a factor or it was a minor factor or whatever. So be wary of advice, even the advice me and Mike are giving right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Be wary of that. Pay more attention to what I've done that actually worked and what Mike has done that actually worked and stuff like that, because that's where like the inarguable truth lies.
Well, you know, we're talking about luck, and I have seen, you know, different startups and projects. Like I'd see it and I go, that's not going to work, because I saw someone do that 5 or 10 years ago and it was an absolute failure. And it was a timing issue. So it wasn't what either of these people were doing. They were both executing really well on it. It was just a timing thing, that internet wasn't quite cheap enough, that, you know, anything else like that. And that makes a huge difference. And so I think that's why I absolutely agree with you that it's really hard to, I think, follow someone else's plan. The best you can do is just try to pull lessons into your own stuff and put it into exactly what you're working on in your market and, you know, take it from there. So,
yeah, completely agreed. Okay, so let's get back to the story, and we might have to kind of compress a lot into a little. But let's go back to, like, you were freelancing, you did the event thing, then you did the, oh, and I forget what it even was. Oh, the sports betting thing.
Yeah.
And what like time period are we talking at that point?
This is like the early 2010s. So, okay. You know, it's like five to eight years ago. So,
okay. So in the 10 minutes that we have left, what has happened in the 8 years since then?
I think the other big thing is, so out of that, I eventually got a big contract with a Y Combinator company called Meta.
Oh, okay.
And they did augmented reality glasses. And they have since gone defunct, which is a whole other story. But prior to their Y Combinator demo day, which is a huge day for any Y Combinator company where they get a tremendous amount of traffic, they have all sorts of things. Their website had been built by an intern, and every single page load, I think, was around 20 megabytes. And it was a disaster waiting to happen. So they were desperate for someone to come in who really understood Rails, who had some sort of passion and interest in the space, which I did and do. And really—
Wait, the space meaning what?
Augmented reality, virtual reality.
Got it.
Just
okay.
An interest in that, and who could really just execute and take care of things. And that's what I did. So I came in and basically fixed up their site. It was on Heroku, got things straightened out with a bunch of different things, and it was a big success for them. And so I started doing more projects for them. And one of the big projects I did was a sort of contest that was structured to take advantage of social media, where people could post their augmented reality ideas to it, and they would OAuth with Twitter or Facebook. And the core of the project was around the behaviors of people. So you would post your idea and then have others vote on it. And so it had a bit of virality to it. And that was their main traffic driver for years.
Okay.
To the site, and a really big success for them in terms of getting awareness in the exact communities they wanted to reach. And that sort of started me down the path of doing more and more marketing related digital projects, where I call those like content engineering projects, where it's not like writing blog posts, but it's building tools and interesting things to draw attention.
Okay. So sorry, let me stop you and back up sure. A little bit. How did this gig come about? Did they find you? Did you find them? How did that work?
I actually saw it on Hacker News. Like, they have job postings, and I wrote them a pitch letter and talked to them, and then was on a plane like 2 days later. So
was it the monthly Who's Hiring or like Seeking Freelancer type thing?
It was not. It was an individual job posting that Meta needs a Rails developer for such and such. And so
it was a slot for a full-time employee, or were they specifically looking for a contractor?
It was a freelance position. So there.
Those are kind of rare in my experience, like a freelance position, somebody specifically looking for a freelancer or contractor, where, because usually in my experience, people are looking for a freelancer when they like can't afford to hire a full-time employee. And usually those are like, either they can't like afford to have somebody full-time, or they just like have a tiny, tiny job or something like that. And so to find something like that where it's a good company with money, that's kind of rare in my experience. Is that your experience too, or different?
I like everything. I think it depends. And I think even freelancer versus full-time is a negotiating point often, where, you know, you can say like, I can knock this out of the park, but as an, you know, a company that's doing AR, you know, augmented reality hardware, do they need a full-time developer for their website? Like, you know, it's not really core to exactly what they do. So, you know, I worked for them for a number of years, just remotely, just keeping the website going and a few little internal projects. So,
Okay. And what was your situation at the time? It sounds like you were proactively, or maybe like me, you're kind of always having your feelers out there, but why were you available at that particular time? Did you have something that ended prior to that, or how did that go?
I was doing a variety of freelance kind of things and was in a good spot and just saw it and thought it seemed really interesting. So made my pitch.
And did you have to like end or wind down or scale down anything else to make room for that?
Yeah, but you know, you kind of think about all your stuff and what you have interest in and what you're passionate about. And it seemed a lot more interesting. So,
yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. Because the challenge of freelancing is like, you can't really make use of every lead that you come across or every lead that falls into your lap or whatever. Because like, right now, if I get a lead for like something really great, it's like, well, that's nice, but I can't do anything with this. Because it would be irrational for me to quit what I'm doing now and do this other thing, because it would just be like a lateral move. And so that's tough. And I used to think that the answer to like, and there's also like the risk of like, if you work for one client at a time and it ends, then you have to scramble to get the next thing. I used to think that the answer to that question, that problem, was to work for multiple clients at once. I got to the point one time where I was working for 8 different clients at once, and it was brutal. And I hated life, and I wasn't actually making that money. I wasn't making that much money because there was so much overhead to having 8 clients. Having 8 clients, you know, it's like having 8 clients who are each 5 hours a week is theoretically a total of 40 hours a week of work, but in reality, it's more like 80 or something like that. And there's just like the mental overhead of having all these clients at once. It's
Context switching, trying to jump between them and what were you doing and which versions of things. And yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, did I remember to do everything I was supposed to do for this one client from 2 weeks ago or whatever? It's a nightmare. So today I work with like one client at a time, although I might have like a small thing on the side once in a while. Like if somebody, like earlier this year, I went and taught a class at Liberty Mutual because they paid me like way more than I was making with my main client. And so that was like an economically rational move to go and take time off of my main work to go do that. So I'll have those little things in between if they're like lucrative enough. But otherwise, I think it's best. Well, I don't know if it's best, but for where I'm at right now with freelancing, working for one client at a time for a pretty long period of time, that's a much better way to do it than trying to work for like 8 clients at once.
Yeah, I think there's a sweet spot, you know, and you know, just try to find the best situation for your own situation. So
yeah, and I think it can be good to like ratchet up, like start with full-time employment doing freelancing on the side. And then maybe you can transition into your first freelance gig that way. I'm catching myself giving advice again, and I don't want to give advice to people. I want to share what I actually did instead. But let me transition from that and say we're getting close to our time limit. So hopefully, Mike, you're up for another one. We can talk about that offline after this. But sure. Is there anything you want to leave the listeners with? And then also, where can people find you online? Where can they find your products online? All that kind of stuff.
Oh, sure. So I'm on Twitter at mbuckby, Mike Buckby, and always happy to chat with people. And if you want to check out Expedited Security, it's at expeditedsecurity.com. And if you're on Heroku, we have a number of add-ons. The two biggest are Expedited SSL and Expedited WAF, the Web Application Firewall, which is the new product we've just launched.
Awesome. And I'll put all those in the show notes. Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you, Jason. This is great.
So. Yeah. And one last thing that I want to say to you, dear listener, is that if you like this episode and if there's any kind of stuff that you want to hear more of, because we like barely scratched the surface in this interview. If you want to learn more about like freelancing or selling products online or anything like that, send me an email, jason@codewithjason.com, and just let me know, like, what would you like to hear anything more about? And that'll really help inform future episodes. Okay. Goodbye, everyone. See you next time.